Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Arreta, arreta, which of course is Basque for Achtung, Achtung. Not that Spaniards in the Basque country were allowed to use their language during World War II. Franco suppressed the use of Basque, Catalan and Galician. Well, anyway.
But it didn't stop some Basques going into Paris and
no, of course
leading
not.
The way in
August 1944. Of course not. And that's James Holland, of course. I'm Al Murray. And we're releasing this episode on November the 11th, which is, of course, Remembrance Day.
Yeah, and it's always a moving day, and it's always a time for just pausing and reflecting a little bit. And
yeah.
We were thinking it would be nice to do a little podcast today. And one person that I wanted to bring up was Keith Douglas.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot about First World War poets, Siegfried Sassoon, Wilfred Owen, etc., etc. And not much about Second World War poets, but there were some very talented ones, and I think Keith Douglas is very much top of the pile.
Well, he's the one I've always known about. I remember when, because, you know, inevitably I did Wilfred Owen for O-level, it's not that long ago, around about the time of the Falklands War, was that long ago. But we did Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon and all that stuff, Robert Graves, goodbye to all that. We did all that in English O-level. And I remember, like, wandering off-piste and discovering a Second World War poet, this guy, Keith Douglas. And I used to think, well, why aren't there any more? Why don't we know any more? What does it all mean? But that's not what we're here to talk about. He was a brilliant writer.
He's a brilliant writer, and he's a really interesting man, and he joins my favourite armoured regiment of all time, which is the Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry, which is this TA regiment, Yeomanry regiment. And they're extraordinary, really, because they go off to war in September 1939. They get sent to Palestine. There's this amazing photograph of them at summer camp in Lord Yarborough's estate in August 1939, and they're all looking like sort of 50 years out of date on their chargers, you know, with leather Sam Browns and ammunition pouches, all leather, and looking very spick and span. And they go off, they look completely ill-suited kind of to a modern war. They go off their chargers to Palestine. They're involved in one of the last sabres-drawn cavalry charges of the war against Arab insurrectionists. They later on, their horses in early 1940 have a stampede and they're taken away from them. And then kind of massively infra dig for them, they're made into artillery, and some of them get sent to Crete and some of them get sent to Tobruk, and they're in the siege of Tobruk. And a squadron, which then becomes a battery, commanded by a chap called Stanley Christopherson. And David, his son, is a great mate of mine, and I ended up editing Stanley's wartime diaries. And later on, they then, you know, once Britain manages to make enough tanks, then they become mechanized.
Right.
And their first action, having been mechanised, having got over Crete, having got over the siege of Tobruk, got over the losing of their horses and all the rest of it, is the Battle of Alam Halfa, which is the last time Rommel goes forward in the desert in Egypt, at the very end of August, beginning of September 1942, and a precursor to the Second Battle of Alamein. And as the war progresses, they perform better and better and better. And what's really interesting by studying Stanley Christopherson's diaries is you sense that there is this growing pride. They've gone over and it's all a bit kind of jolly hockey sticks and, you know, all a bit of a laugh and all the rest of it. And they're rank amateurs and they become more and more professional. And by the time it's post-Alamein, you see them sort of going, you know, they really want to train and learn and be better.
Yeah.
Because they recognise that there is a pride about this, but there's also their chances of survival are better if they're better. You know, if they're better trained and better at being soldiers.
Yeah.
And you know, there's lots of analysis about all arms training with infantry and artillery and all the rest of it. And they have this quite traumatic time. They lose a number of sort of key characters in the regiment. But after the Tunisian battle ends in May 1943, they're then pulled out and sent back over to Britain to be the spearhead of the invasion. They land on Gold Beach on D-Day, move into Bayeux on the 7th of June. And then on the 8th of June, they're overlooking Tilly-sur-Sul, where they come slap, bang, crash into the Panzerlehr as they're coming up from Le Mans. And yeah. Panzerlehr, of course, is probably the best panzer unit in the Wehrmacht at that stage. And they're the ones that have to confront them. And they stop them in their tracks.
Yeah.
And by this stage, Keith Douglas, who has joined the regiment before Alamein, he's a grammar school boy. He's not a hunt and shoot and fishing, you know.
He's not a chap.
He's not a chap, and he's not from the Shire. He's incredibly short-sighted. He's incredibly vain. He's incredibly chippy. But he's also an incredibly sensitive soul. And he describes the people that he's with and serving with ultimately, I think, a huge amount of affection. And it's very interesting that he's quite rude about Stanley Christopherson, who he calls Edward in Alamein to Zemzem, which is his brilliant memoir, which is also illustrated by his equally brilliant sketches, incredibly vivid sketches of life, of war in the Western desert. He calls him Edward, and you know, he always sort of makes out that Edward is a slightly sort of slight... not very sort of, you know, not a man of any kind of depth whatsoever, which I think is really, really unfair.
Yeah.
But what Stanley really objects to, more than he doesn't mind that when he reads the manuscript, what he really objects to is the fact that Keith Douglas has criticised his ability as a dancer. And that's what really gets his goat, and he gets him to change it, but not the kind of character assassination. But anyway, on the 9th of June, they're pushing down into a little village called Saint-Pierre, which is on the other side of the Soule from Tilly, Sur-Soule. And... on the 8th of June, this is where they first come against the first German troops. And Keith Douglas sees these Germans coming towards them, fires a couple of pistol shots and runs away.
Yeah.
And that's the first clash against Panzerlehr. And the next day, they're in battle, their engagement. A squadron is in battle. And for no reason whatsoever, Keith Douglas gets out of his tank to go and talk to someone else and gets hit by a shard of... shrapnel and is killed instantly. Gets a bit of shrapnel on the head and he's killed instantly, and he's buried at the Tilly-sur-Sul cemetery. Like a lot of these cemeteries, when they're smaller, they're often a lot more moving than the big ones, where you're sort of just swamped by you're overcome by the enormity and size of it. But sometimes when you're in these little cemeteries, you've got a chance to look at literally every grave. And there he is, interestingly, on the hill that was occupied by the Panzerlehr, not the Sherwood Rangers, until obviously it was captured by the Sherwood Rangers later on. But it's an interesting spot. And he did write this fantastic account of these guys just at the point where they're tipping from being rank amateurs to really rather good.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting about the Sherwood Rangers is you can use them as a leitmotif for the British Army in the Second World War. They start the war needing to catch up quite a lot. They're a little bit behind the times. They need to get better. But by the end of the war, they're really pretty good. And what's interesting about Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry is they end up as the single unit in the British Army with more battle honours than any other.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to read a little bit of Alamein to Zemzem by Keith Douglas, which is his account. This is him talking about radio practice in the desert. Here we go. Each speaker has his own code name, shortened after the initial netting calls to a letter and a number, or simply a letter in the case of a control station. We're quite inconsistent. Some of these letters change daily, some never change. Some are codes, some simply initials or Christian and nicknames, which gave us away to the enemy more often than anything else. All these disguises are used and interchanged according to whim. The enemy, who wants to find out what kind of formation we are and if he has seen us before, and a great many smaller details, is not much deceived by our mysterious asides. But this we are not to find out until later. Piccadilly Jim is accustomed to say, and in sanguine moments we believe him, that we have a good wireless discipline. This should mean that no one interrupts or speaks at unnecessary length and that every vital message gets through in one. In fact, it means that we keep off the air when Piccadilly Jim is speaking while he interrupts, dilates or ignores messages entirely. No one ever interrupts or ignores him. For this offence, no stress of battle except death is an excuse. The result of this is clearly that whatever happens, Piccadilly Jim retains absolute control of the air and therefore of the regimental group. It may mean that he misses important information. There are painful moments when a somewhat facetious conversation of Jim's, "Oh, there you are, nuts orange. That's just where I want you. I'm very pleased to see you. Look, I'm waving to you. I'm taking off my hat to you. I'm blowing you a kiss. Over?" And the required reply, "Nuts orange, okay, off." Drown an anxious message. King 2, act. Six enemy tanks advancing towards me on my right. They're out of my range. Could George ever go at them? Over. But in general, Piccadilly Jim is given a good idea of anything which is happening outside his own vision by the Crusader Squadron. From the first appearance of the enemy, a Crusader troop leader, well out in front of the regiment, sees and hears the whole action, almost as if it were a pageant prepared for his entertainment. For hours on end, it may continue to be exciting in quite an impersonal way. He sees a suspicious blob on the horizon, halts his squat turret, almost level with the ridge, and scrutinises the blob through his glasses. Pressing the switch of his microphone, releasing it a moment to see if someone else is talking, and pressing it again, he says, "King 2, something looks like a tank to my front, about 3 miles, I'm on your right, over." "King 2, okay, off to you. King, did you hear King 2's message?" "King, yes, let him keep bumming on, but be cautious, off," says Piccadilly Jim to Edward. "King 1, says Edward, calling the squadron, "slow down a bit and have a good look from hull down before you go swanning off over ridges, over." 2 okay off, 3 okay off, 4 okay off. "King 2, 3, 4, okay off to you." "King 5, did you get my last message?" "King 5, yes, over." "King 5, well, bloody well, wake up and acknowledge." "Off, off," caps the rebuke like a telephone receiver being hung up. We have two main sources of illusion: horses and cricket. "Uncle Tom, what's the going like over this next bit? Can we bring the unshod horses over it?" "Uncle Tom, I'm just going over beaches myself. You want to hold them in a bit and go carefully, but after that, it's good going for the whole field." "King 2, ack," says someone who's broken a track. "I shall need the farrier. I've cast a shoe. Someone else is having trouble with my horse's insides. Could I have the vet?" Metaphor changes. "King 2, somebody's throwing stones. I can't see where from yet. Over." And a little later, Piccadilly Jim asks, "King 2, now that that chap has retired to the pavilion, how many short of a full team are you?" As the action goes on, metaphors, direct speech, codes, sequences of messages are intermingled until a good deal of concentration is needed to disentangle them. "King 2, there are a couple of 88s on that grey ridge to my right. One is near the brew up and the other to the left of it, about 2 degrees. Over." "King 2, okay, off to you, orange pip. Can you see those 88s of King 2's? Over." "George 4, is that a vehicle moving in your front right? Over." "Orange pip, yes, getting gunfire on now." "Over." "George 4, yes, I reported it just now." "Over." "George 4, can you bring fire on it?" "King, have you anything to report?" "Over." "George, one of your children came up in the middle of my transmission just then. When I was trying to talk to King, it's most difficult and annoying, and I won't have it. Tell him to bloody well keep off the air when I'm trying to fight a battle." "Off to you." "King, King, have you anything to report?" "Over." "King, King, signals." "Over." "King 2, I think one of those guns is being towed away." "Over." "King 2, or whoever that is, get off the bloody air when I'm trying to talk to somebody." "Off." "King, King, signals." "Over." "King strength, Niner, I'm sorry, I was talking to my jockey. Could you say again? Over." And so on. Fantastic.
Isn't it brilliant?
Yeah.
I remember reading that for the first time and absolutely just crying with laughter.
It's a very, very, I mean, this is a great book. I mean, he wrote this, this was written and published during the war, you know, but this is...
It was published before D-Day.
Before D-Day. So this is completely contemporary, written in the moment, written at the time. That's what's so great about this book. Anyway, he's also a poet.
Yes, and the poetry is, it's profoundly moving, I've got to say. You know, that's obviously very funny. There are some very moving bits in the book as well. But the poems are of a, you know, I think he does have a touch of the black dog. And well, he might, after what he's gone through. But this is an amazing poem. And it doesn't matter how many times I read it, I always find it incredibly, it just really, really gets me. It's called "Vergiss mein Nicht," which, as all you German speakers will know, means "forget me not." 3 weeks gone and the combatants gone, returning over the nightmare ground. We found the place again and found the soldier sprawling in the sun, the frowning barrel of his gun overshadowing. As we came on that day, he hit my tank with one like the entry of a demon. Look, here in the gun pit spoil, the dishonoured picture of his girl, who has put "Steffi, vergiss mein Nicht" in a copybook Gothic script. We see him almost with content, abased, and seeming to have paid and mocked at by his own equipment, that's hard and good when he's decayed. But she would weep to see today how on his skin the swart flies move, the dust upon the paper eye, and the burst stomach like a cave. For here the lover and killer are mingled, who had one body and one heart, and death, who had the soldier singled, has done the lover mortal hurt. Hmm. And actually, he did a sketch of that soldier.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Which is in Alamein to Zemzem. And, you know, you can't read the poem without the image coming to mind. And yeah, he just does it so vividly. It's
fantastic.
It's heartbreaking,
writer,
isn't it?
Keith Douglas, yes.
And, of course, about a German soldier, not a British.
Yeah. Well, at 11 o'clock on the 11th of November 1918, the guns of the First World War fell silent. 101 years ago. And the first ever two-minute silence actually took place on this day in 1919, 100 years ago precisely. Goodbye from us.
Yep, goodbye.